Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I sat down and spoke to writer Lily Herman. We talked about her new project, Get Her Elected, that matches volunteers with women running for office to help with the nuts and bolts of their campaign, the thing that a lot of people don't think about when they say they're going to run for office.
We deal with a lot of, in terms of onboarding, things like, you know, I have a website, it's terribly designed, can someone just make improvements? You know, I wrote out my issue stances, but I'm not a writer. Can someone wordsmith it so I sound like I know what I'm talking about, because I do know what I want, but I don't know how to say it in the most prosy sense. So we deal with a lot more of that question of not should I run or how to run, but once you're in the race, all the little tiny things that seem to pop up almost out of nowhere.
It was a great conversation, and I'm really excited to share it with you. But first, a few updates. Tonight is Life is a Living Nightmare, a Telethon to Fix It, by Lady Parts Justice. So the founder of Lady Parts Justice, Liz Winstead, was on the show last week, and it will be live tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern time on ladypartsjustice.com and Liz Winstead's Facebook page. So when we talked to Liz last week, we discussed abortion, Mike Pence, women's reproductive rights, comedy's role in the political narrative, and she's hilarious. And I'm actually going to be there. So if you can catch me looking awkward in a room full of beautiful celebrities, bonus points. It's going to be a really fun event. Mark Hamill's going to be there auctioning off drawings and Star Wars memorabilia. It's going to be a lot of fun. In lieu of feedback this week, I want to take a few minutes to talk about this hashtag release the memo bullshit. This is a terrifying and dangerous game that Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee are playing. To release classified information to the public without proper context to boot is not transparency, it's manipulation. It's worth noting that all but one person at the FBI who was informed of Comey's contemporaneous notes about Trump's request to drop the investigation into Flynn have been moved, fired, or pressed out of their job. The one person who hasn't is Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. And since Sessions recused himself from any investigations involving Russia meddling in the election and Trump's campaign, Rosenstein is in charge of the Mueller investigation. So it's widely believed that this classified memo that they voted to release and the FBI is trying to block was possibly written by the White House. If you remember Devin Nunes, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, before had some spy bullshit documents that the White House had given him, and he had this weird press conference, and then he recused himself from any oversight of the Mueller investigation. But apparently that is not quite true, and he has actually maybe not himself been involved, but his staff has probably been involved. At a hearing the other day, Representative Mike Quigley asked Nunes, who wrote the memo, asked if it had been his staff, it had been him, and Nunes just refused to answer and said, you're out of time, and went on to the next person, which makes me very suspicious that Nunes has been more involved in the Mueller investigation oversight than previously thought. So this memo could be possibly written by the White House, and it's widely believed that it's designed to undermine Rod Rosenstein. So it's likely about corruption in the FBI, and specifically about Rosenstein signing off on a wiretap of Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. This fucker just keeps coming up. I mean, I feel like Carter Page just pops up whenever there's something juicy going on. But they're questioning Rosenstein and his ability to oversee the Mueller investigation, and that might lay the groundwork for Trump to fire Rosenstein and potentially replace him with someone more, quote, loyal to the president. And it's not a long jump from replacing Rosenstein to nerfing or ending the Mueller investigation. And we've discussed how politically dangerous it would be for Trump to fire Mueller, but this might be a loophole that he or someone much smarter than he is trying to exploit. And it's also worth noting that this week, Trey Gowdy left his role as a congressman to, quote, return to the justice system. And so my question is, does he expect a job at the DOJ to be open sometime soon? Before we get into the interview, I want to award Hellion of the Week, And I'll make this quick. This is a person who was just our Hellion, but it is our podcast and we can do what we want. So Hellion for this week is Maxine Waters. She gave a fire response to Trump's State of the Union, which is a whole other mess that I don't have time to get into, but I'm sure Drexel and I will talk about on Monday. Maxine Waters decimated Trump's State of the Union address, but I think there's one line that really sums it up, and this is why she's Hellion of the Week. She said, quote, "This president, with his vulgarity and his disrespect for women and people of color, is a terrible role model for our children. Whenever he appears on TV, there should be a disclaimer that says, this may not be acceptable for children." And I think that just sums up everything that Maxine Waters has been saying about President Trump and everything in the State of the Union that was just so gaslighty and manipulative and just kind of gross. And I think that just sums it up really nicely. Like, we really shouldn't let our children watch this man on TV. Our guest today is Lily Herman, a freelance writer whose work has appeared in Teen Vogue, Refinery 29, Time, Business Insider, and more. She also runs Get Her Elected and the popular newsletter Network Bitch. Welcome, Lily.
Hi.
Hi.
Super excited to be here.
Yeah, I think Network Bitch is my favorite name for a newsletter ever.
Thank you. I did not come up with it.
No,
it is
good,
all because of my friend Anna. Anything I name is usually terrible.
Oh, it is not my strong suit. Full disclosure, you interviewed Sarah and I for your pop culture blog, The Q.
I did. Way back in the day.
Way back in the day. I know it was a while ago. And you write about Riverdale, which is my secret TV love.
There's a lot going on. I need to catch up.
I know,
haven't written posts on the last two episodes, which they were pretty bad. So there's like not a lot of motivation there.
I know.
To keep going.
You're really, really disappointed. So, Lily, can you tell us a little bit about Get Her Elected and what the inspiration was behind Get Her Elected?
Yes. So, kind of a higher level concept. Get Her Elected is a network of volunteers who offer their skills pro bono to progressive women candidates running for office. So, numbers wise, right now we have almost 2,000 volunteers as of kind of late January, early February 2018, and we're helping almost 170 progressive women candidates running in almost every state in the US. They are running for everything from local city council or school board, all the way up to U.S. House of Representatives or U.S. Senate. So what do I mean by people donating skills? What are those skills? I get that question a lot. We have everything from writing and editing to graphic design and web design work. We have people who have accounting backgrounds, data analysis or data entry backgrounds. And then we also have people who kind of do everything in between. Now, the inspiration for it was from the fact that, you know, I've worked on campaigns, I've volunteered for campaigns, I know women who've run in the past, and over time, even before Donald Trump was elected, I kind of noticed this interesting break in that pipeline of getting women to run and then run successfully, where there are so many amazing, amazing organizations, be it Emily's List, She Should Run, Now Run for Something, and a bunch of other that were there both before and after the election, that help inspire women candidates to run. They kind of get them started. They show them the basics of actually filing the paperwork and setting up, you know, your fundraising infrastructure and all of that. But a lot of candidates that I knew personally and also heard from felt like they were sort of left to fend for themselves once it came to the actual process of campaigning and running. So
right.
You had a lot of women who were coming into that pipeline, but then we're getting stuck for a variety of reasons. And a lot of these organizations just don't have the bandwidth, the resources, or even the mission to help those women once they're actually in the thick of the race. And a lot of the women we work with are first-time candidates. They're women who don't have the money to get some gigantic political consultancy to come in and work with them. They're sort of on their own for this. And a lot of them then don't have the support to get elected. They don't kind of have the know-how to know right off the bat how to do certain things in campaigns. And at the same time, though, these are women who are excellent people. They're the people you would want in office. And I think that a lot of them are going to change our country and the world. So, why not do a little bit of volunteer work to get them there and get them elected and get them in office?
Right, right. My next question, you sort of answered. Two-part question. Why offer services pro bono?
Yeah.
Obviously, they don't have those sort of resources or the money to bring in a political consultancy, like you said. And the next one, you said you have almost 2,000 volunteers. My question was, do you have a hard time recruiting volunteers to offer their services pro bono?
Yes and no. I think it's kind of a two-part question. So one, we don't really have too much trouble. I think it's just a matter of exposure and people seeing it. But then we find that once we either hit a nerve with a potential or a particular political event, or we get into a certain Facebook group or something like that, it all kind of takes care of itself. The big question is making sure that we have, or how many of each skill set we have in terms of volunteers. So for instance, we have a gigantic number of writing and editing volunteers. Right now, today, we need a lot more graphic design volunteers because we had a huge increase in our, the requests from candidates who need graphic designers. So, you know, recruiting the numbers in general are important, but making sure we have one, high quality volunteers, and two, volunteers and things that candidates have needs for. That's where I think it gets a little bit trickier, is making sure we're not just playing a numbers game, but making sure that those numbers make sense for the demand we have.
Right. And how do you deploy these resources? Candidates apply. How do you choose who to help and where to dedicate your time?
Yeah. So the good news about saying up front that we are a progressive organization, we are partisan in that sense, is that weeds out a lot of people. So I've never had a Republican candidate come to us. We don't really get many centrist candidates. Progressive, though, we do have some key criteria that we look for, be it things like candidates that are pro-choice and pro-abortion. We look for candidates that obviously believe in climate change, that, you know, want to end gun violence in the country and have solutions for that. We look at a bunch of progressive education policy agenda items. But the other thing we do too is look holistically at that candidate, look at, where they're running, what we need to know about that race and what progressivism means to them. We also look a lot at the specific positions that these candidates are running for. So for instance, if you're running for local school board, I'm going to care a lot more about, you know, that you're not just progressive overall, but what are your progressive education policies?
Right.
And, you know, for example, right now, free college tuition is getting a lot of lip service, but there's a ton of other education policies that are considered progressive, namely for kindergarten through 12th grade education. So I want to know, you know, what's going on with that, and you're not just kind of paying lip service to I'm a progressive without anything to back it up. So we do spend some time on that and researching those candidates, getting a sense of who they are. We don't base who we end up working with on their chances of winning the race. I think part of the problem is the fact that currently our political system and our political parties will spend a lot of time in only a couple of races, but then not really bet a lot on those other candidates in states or districts that they think just aren't up to snuff. So we don't let that factor into our decision, and we also don't factor in which state it's in. I think it's important that progressive women are visible in any state. So we have women who are running in a lot of battleground states, a lot of purple states, and then also you have women who are running, you know, in the middle of Kentucky or Alaska, but they're up against a really big red wave, but they are more than willing to take it on.
I hear a lot from women, I don't feel qualified, or I don't know where to start. So how can organizations like Get Her Elected take some of that pressure off?
Yeah, so we don't help necessarily with the where do I start, but I think for women who get through that, you know, we talked to a lot of women who went to a training with a specific organization or a series of events. So they're ready to run, but then they say, wait a second, I just realized how much stuff I need to do. So that's where we can kind of and say, okay, what requests do you have off the bat? What are things you need that you just do not have money for but are important? So we deal with a lot of, in terms of onboarding, things like, you know, I have a website, it's terribly designed, can someone just make improvements? You know, I wrote out my issue stances, but I'm not a writer. Can someone wordsmith it so I sound like I know what I'm talking about? Because I do know what I want, but I don't know how to say it in the most prosy sense.
Right.
So we deal with a lot more of that question of not should I run or how to run, but once you're in the race, all the little tiny things that seem to pop up almost out of nowhere, we're also dealing too, I think, which is important, with a lot of first-time campaign staffers and campaign managers. So they also have just as many questions about how to run a race, what it looks like, you know, how to craft issue stances, should they write op-eds in newspapers nearby? Yeah. Video editing, like all these little tiny things that you don't think about, but we just think in our minds, oh, to have a well-run campaign, you need a good digital strategy, but no one actually unpacks the execution of making that happen. So,
and the cost associated with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people forget that part of it or just don't think through the numbers. So graphic designers, for instance, can cost anywhere from hundreds of dollars to thousands for one or two or three designs. I talked to a lot of candidates who had two questions to ask someone about maybe fundraising or just political strategy. And they were told that they couldn't get those two questions, which would take 10 minutes to answer, without paying, you know, an hourly rate of $500 an hour or what have you. Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made in campaigns, which is part of the problem. And therefore, a lot of these women are not getting that attention because they just don't have the money to cough up, which again, I see as a good thing that we have, you know, people and everyday Americans, as folks like to say, who want to run for office and change the way our country works, but they just don't have the money to play in that sort of game.
Right. I want to switch tacks a little bit here. You recently wrote an article for Teen Vogue entitled "Politicians Accused of Sexual Misconduct in 2017. And the fact that we have articles like this is extremely depressing. What did the research for this article look like? Were there tons and tons of people accused of sexual misconduct? Was it pretty straightforward? Were you shocked by anything you found?
I think when a lot of the sexual misconduct stuff started in October, everyone knows the key players of Donald Trump. Everyone knows the Al Franken case. What I think is so difficult is how widespread a lot of these issues are, and especially on the state and local levels. That article doesn't even cover, I think at this point, all of these state legislators, for instance, both Democrats and Republicans, who have now been forced out of office or undergoing internal investigations over their conduct. So I think that was just a lot of work and really overwhelming, was how do you keep up with now the demand, especially given how many revelations are coming up each day. And also there's so many that don't make the national news. So again, we know about these cases that deal with our federal politicians, but a lot of people couldn't tell you about the issues they're having, for instance, in Colorado or California, unless you're kind of privy to that information or you follow people on Twitter who tweet about stuff like that. You just wouldn't know the extent. And also each of those particular cases, it usually comes from a larger culture of violence against women, sexual harassment, things like that. So you're really, with each of those individual allegations, unraveling a lot more, which we saw with Weinstein, but now we're seeing in the political realm too.
And sometimes in your own district, you don't even know.
Oh, absolutely. And also keep in mind that we're just seeing what has come out publicly. There's so much more, obviously, as any woman knows, that goes on behind closed doors that we just haven't seen yet, that people are trying to bury. So there could be things happening right under your nose, and you wouldn't know it unless you were some sort of insider or until writers and reporters actually go in and investigate.
I want to talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign and the sexual assault or sexual misconduct allegations levied against a campaign staffer and whom she then chose not to fire. How do you think that factors into this political culture of sexual misconduct?
So admittedly, I actually have not read her response yet. I know she issued a response last night and just haven't gotten around to reading it, so cannot speak to that. But it's interesting. I think, like a lot of people who voted for Clinton in the campaign, there's that initial tug of, well, it happened back in 2008. It should be dismissed. It's not now. But at the same time, we're going after a lot of men and other people who did stuff going back decades. So I think it is an issue. And I think it does reckon with what our culture is and also just what it actually means to practice what we preach in terms of feminism. You know, I think Hillary Clinton, it's sad. For a lot of women who I know really, really supported her, not just to keep Trump from office, but really supported her personally, I think it's really hard to reckon with that she made a decision that was not a particularly feminist decision. Can we say, yeah, it was a different time, obviously, 10 years ago? Oh, yeah. But I think at the end of the day, it's depressing to know that someone was still working in that office, and we saw the same storyline play out that we always do, where woman had to move and the person that was accused or the man didn't and was, you know, pretty much business as usual, even though he did something terrible. So that's sort of where I see the argument going. And I think, again, it's my thing is, let's not pretend that Hillary Clinton's case is so much more important than all these other cases. I think they all paint a larger and much more nuanced picture than that.
Well, one thing she did say in her response was, one thing that you brought up was that the standards around sexual harassment have changed. I found that very interesting, if not true. I mean, obviously true. And it really puts in sharp relief the Al Franken resigning and being pressured to resign by fellow Democrats. Have the standards around sexual misconduct changed?
I think the big thing to keep in mind is that there's what is actually right and wrong, and then what's perceived right and wrong. So all the things we're seeing now, sexual misconduct, harassment, assault, all of it was bad. We should not have been doing it to begin with. The problem is some of it, as we all know now, and as a lot of men are finding out, was just perceived as not bad. And now we're dealing with a lot of it's not as bad as fill in the blank. So I think now there's a lot more backlash than there would have been at the time, depending on what had gone on.
Right.
You know, if we think back to 10 years ago, and also keeping in mind, too, I think historical context is important of Hillary Clinton running that campaign, the sexism she dealt with and all these other things. And I don't think that's an excuse. I think it's just important to keep all of that in mind if you're going to dissect that particular moment. But I do think now, though, people have a heightened sense of these issues and a heightened sense of, hey, things that you maybe thought were okay behavior, they never were, but now you're going to get called out for them, and you could potentially see some repercussions, albeit very temporary ones in most cases. But you will see repercussions or damage to your reputation in a more public manner than you would have 10 years ago. And again, I say that with a lot of hesitation in that we're not seeing a lot of long-term retaliation against men who are accused of these behaviors. So I think it's hard to say that, you know, the culture around it is definitely changing. And I like to say that I hope we're in a movement and not a moment.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like you said about temporary ramifications, if in 2008 she had fired this guy, would that have meant that he would be off the political scene, or would it be business as usual in another campaign? That's my question.
I think he would have ended up somewhere else. I think he would have been totally fine. And yeah. I mean, also keeping in mind, too, most campaigns, part of the reason this is all coming to light at this point is that we are so sensitive, and journalists are going after these stories nowadays in a way that they maybe weren't before. Their publications are protecting them more than they would have even 8 or 9 months ago to tell these stories. So we don't even know if we would have heard had he gotten fired for something. He might have been shuffled around to somewhere else. That's also been a huge story that has really started to come out over the past month or so, is you're hearing a lot more of these stories of men who behaved terribly and then were just shuffled to a different organization and were given glowing recommendations by their previous employer. So who knows? You know, we can only speculate at this point, but I sincerely and highly doubt that he would have faced serious problems getting hired again, or I don't think he would have faced any real long-term career stagnation or anything like that. But I also don't think, too, that it would have been as big of a story given how many other stories there were about Hillary Clinton in that particular race at that time.
So I also want to talk about the newsletter you run, Network Bitch. What is the story there, and why start a newsletter about networking?
Yeah, so I started Network Bitch in October of 2015. At the time, I was a senior in college, and I worked full-time all through college on top of school. So at that point, I was at Wesleyan University in Central Connecticut, not to be confused with Wellesley College, which is where Hillary Clinton went, and not to be confused with the other Wesleyans like Texas Wesleyan, Wesleyan College, Ohio Wesleyan. We are the original Wesleyan, Wesleyan University. But I'm so used to this spiel, it's ridiculous. So I was at Wesleyan. Wesleyan is in, suburban Central Connecticut, about 20, 30 minutes outside of Hartford. And I had done a ton of networking over the course of my, at that point, 3 years of college. And a lot of my network was in New York. Some of them were elsewhere. But essentially, I came back from that summer, and I had, you know, 9 more months to go till I was a professional in the real world and had graduated. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, what are ways I can stay in touch with my network so I don't have to keep individually emailing everyone or tweeting them or trying to set up a million meetings whenever I do go to New York, which is only, you know, 1 or 2 times a semester. So that was sort of the big question. And at the time, newsletters, you know, again, newsletters are everywhere nowadays, but in 2014, 2015, they were really starting to hit their first real, I think, or the latest wave of kind of cultural resonance. So I said, oh, a newsletter, great. I, at that point, had made newsletters for tons of clients and people I'd worked for and bosses. So I thought, why not? I'll make it a monthly thing. I added 20 or 30 friends onto it and said, I'm going to put together this email that has a bunch of gifts in it. Y'all can just deal with it as you please. So that's where it started. And for the longest time, it was really, I really tried to make it something where people just had to refer one other, badass woman to join. That was whatever the, I think that was the cost of entry. But I really didn't advertise it for a really long time until friends and other people were finally like, you really need to do this because it makes sense that you don't. So for about a year plus, it was very much just if you knew someone who was in it, they would get added. I think that got me to 300 or 400 subscribers. And after my work took off, kind of post Teen Vogue ascension and Lauren Duca op-ed, that's when it kind of really took off and where I saw huge numbers of women subscribing. But yeah, that's kind of where it started. And now it's just a monthly newsletter I put out. I try to do it every month, about once a year. There's some month where I just don't do it. But yeah, the hope is that it kind of is a mixture of connecting women to one another. People can give shout outs to themselves or other people. They can submit events that they're throwing. They can let me know about anything else they want women on the list to check out. I include a bunch of different career-related reads and apps that would be good for women. We also have a cool interview section where I do a longer-form interview typically every month with a different woman who has some sort of interesting career story to tell. So it's really just a mix of whatever. I think the great thing about it is I have never put any pressure on myself to grow it at a certain rate or turn it into something bigger or a money-making enterprise. And similarly, I also don't put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure all the content is the same every month. So there are some months where, you know, there will be 20 shout outs and only two other kind of listings. Other months, everyone has something they want everyone to check out, and there are no shout outs and no longer career story. It really just depends on the month. But I think offering myself that flexibility is one of the reasons it's been able to go on for this long, because I just have never felt like, you know, I never acted like the world was going to end. If it didn't go out exactly the same way every month, or it wasn't growing at a certain rate. So, you know, nowadays it grows at a pretty consistent rate, but you know, that wasn't always the case, but I was always really, really okay with that.
Have you found since starting Get Her Elected that your work on Network Bitch and Get Her Elected have overlapped? So do women from one project get involved in the other?
Yeah, it's weird. I have a bunch of other random things I do too. So I feel like my whole network is a little bit both really big and really small.
Yeah.
I'm never surprised when, for instance, a woman emails me about including something in the Network Bitch newsletter, and I recognize her name, and sure enough, she's a Get Her Elected volunteer, or she follows me on Twitter and tweets at me, you know, rather frequently, or something like that. That hasn't really surprised me at all. We've also had some really weird synergy things where, you know, I want to say last month we had a woman who asked us to promote her newsletter, and then another woman emailed me to say that the woman who had emailed me, so the woman with the newsletter, was a girl that she had known in elementary school, but they lived on opposite ends of the country. Like, it was the weirdest, you know, things like that are really odd. But that happens, again, not infrequently. So yeah, it's sort of a really weird, amorphous and really big and yet really tiny network all at the same time. But I feel like, I don't know, I feel like people kind of jump. There's some people who really like to jump into whatever I'm working on, which is really nice. So, you know, whatever kind of project comes next, you know, I see a lot of familiar names and faces.
Can we just take a hot second to do a little celebration of women helping women? Because it's amazing. It's amazing. I was just saying the other day that I'm shocked when I do interviews, I always ask for gratitude checks. And the number of women who use that time to shout out to other women is a lot, and it's fantastic. So how can our listeners sign up to either get support in their campaigns or volunteer to work on other women's campaigns?
Great question. So people just have to go to getherelected.com. If you accidentally type in getherelected.com, it also redirects to our page. So getherelected.com. Yes, I was looking out for everyone. You go to that website, getherelected.com. We have information on there. We have our FAQs listed for both volunteers and candidates. So, you know, you can get the about page and then check out what you need to know as a volunteer, what you need to know as a candidate that we work with. And then we just ask everyone to, we have a contact form. That's just the easiest way to do it. So feel free to fill out that contact form. If you're a volunteer, just say hi, say what your skills are. If you have a LinkedIn page, include that, or a portfolio. It's just nice for us to check those out, because we do vet our volunteers to make sure that we are not getting trolls or what have you. And then on the same token, if you're a candidate who's applying to work with us, or, you know, you want access to the network, just make sure you include a Facebook page, a website, whatever sort of digital trail you have that we can look into and kind of start vetting your positions and all of that. That makes it easiest. But yeah, we, you know, and even if someone doesn't include a ton of information, we'll usually follow up with them, and we answer every email that comes in. So, yeah, within reason, as long as it's not someone trolling us. But if you're an interested person, then we'll figure it out.
Awesome. So, last question, Lily, what are you grateful for today? I mean, these are pretty dark times we live in. So, what is keeping you happy these days?
Oh goodness. Okay, what am I grateful for? You know what? Okay. I know we're talking about women shouting at women. So like, shout out to all of those women. I have to say I'm very, very grateful for really good fine cheese, because I've been tweeting yes. about this, and I know it sounds weird, but no. I've turned every Saturday of 2018 into treat yourself cheese Saturday. And every week there's a website for, you know, one of those food delivery sites. And they have a whole section dedicated to fine cheeses. And every week I get a ton of joy out of going on and like picking out a cheese that looks really good and interesting. So
that is amazing.
Everyone on Twitter knows, yes, it was wonderful. Last week I had a truffle Gouda. It was amazing. So I'm very grateful for fine cheeses and crafting a full day to enjoy a giant block of cheese.
I love that. That's yeah. such excellent self-care. That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Lily, for joining us. So you can follow Lily on Twitter at LK Herman, and you can follow Get Her Elected at I Got Her Elected. And you can find the link to sign up for Network Bitch in Lily's Twitter bio. So again, thank you so much, Lily.
No, thank you. This is awesome.
This is great. All right. All right, Hellions, that is it for me today. Remember, you can watch the Lady Parts Justice Telethon tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern at ladypartsjustice.com. And our researcher, Varsha, actually reminded me that we used to end the show with feminist quotes, and I have completely forgotten about it. And so today I return with a feminist quote from Betty Davis. It's one of my favorites. Quote, when a man gives his opinion, he's a man. When a woman gives her opinion, she's a bitch. So, Hellions, I will leave you with that for the remainder of the week. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Devin Handy, and you can follow Hellbent at Hellbent Pod. And we're still updating our Insta stories with mine and Sarah's take on the news. And you can find us at Instagram at Hellbent Pod. And I will see you back here on Monday.